Because now we're ready to start some silliness. Chapter 7 is silly, and chapter 8 is even sillier. Extra, extra, read all about it. All right. No, not a whole lot. Few. I'll emphasize. Whatever's in the presentation, but you'll find it's not that much. There's not that much. There's not that much here. Nobody has the edition 3 or 2. I don't get the second edition. If you have edition 4, 5, or 6 of the book, I think it just came out 7. Chapter 7 is Stock Price Behavior and Market Efficiency. And if I were naming it, I would name the chapter Can You Beat the Market, right? Because that's a big bugaboo. People say, whoa, can you beat the market? Can you beat the S&P 500? Well, maybe that's a good thing to look at, but certainly the Dow, but you don't look at the Dow. But we'll see that markets are not efficient. I mean, even though there are people who say they are, they're not. And Sir Isaac Newton probably said it the best. I can calculate the movement of stars, but not the madness of men. And that's, the Sir Isaac Newton, or the apple and the calculus and all that stuff. Planetary force equals mass times acceleration. He ought to know, he's dead now, but he did know. He did find out because he invested in one of them. He invested in one of the Bernie Madoffs at the time. It's nothing new, folks. It's technology changes, but we don't. And he got burnt. He lost a lot of money in one of the extraordinary popular delusions in the madness of crowds at the time. So, the random walk and efficient markets. Much of this research started in the late 1960s and then blossomed in the 1970s, and took it, basically made its triumphant success was the Vanguard Index 500 Fund. They weren't the only ones to do it, but they certainly became the most successful and popular. And what is the theory? It's a theory that stock price movements are unpredictable. In the short term, if you look at stock price movements, there is no pattern that you can discern. There's no pattern that anybody can discern. And the only company that was considered to have done it in the 1990s was called Long Term Capital Management, and they failed miserably and almost took the markets down with them. But the problem is with this theory that if you look at the stock market in the long term, oh yes, if you don't look at day to day, month to month, or even year to year, but if you look over decades, there is a pattern. We hope there's a pattern. We don't want the world economies to fail, or unless something comes along that's better than capitalism. If something comes along that's better than capitalism, we're all being well fed and well clothed and well sheltered, and we don't have these capital markets and economics and all that. Great, I'll be very happy. I'd like having my belly filled, but it seems like the only thing that we have to do that so far is capitalism. So, the random walk theories believe that when you have an efficient market, a market in which securities reflect all possible information quickly and accurately, then investors react quickly to this new information, and security prices will adjust quickly and accurately, and they are perfectly priced at any given time, which is, as we'll see, patently absurd. It's obviously not true. But what's an efficient market? You need thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of millions of investors all buying and selling and reacting to events as they take place. Does that make sense? So, yeah or no? New York Stock Exchange, NASDAQ, the Borsa in Germany, and the London exchanges, Hong Kong, Japan. These exchanges are efficient markets because there are no one or two people or groups that have an edge over anybody else. When that happens, it's not an efficient market, and people can get in there and play with the prices and manipulate it. Do you remember Bitcoin? Have you been following that? Don't. Unless you just want to learn about how people get fleeced. Because this thing started, Bitcoin, it wasn't efficient, and there were people who were manipulating it and made tons of money, and other people have lost. And then all of a sudden people started getting ripped off. They started finding ways to steal the stuff. There's a wonderful book we've already made mention of called A Random Walk Down Wall Street. And eventually you want to read that book. It might not be the first book. You guys do like to read books, right? Books. You can put them on your iPod. What? What did she say? 50 Shades of Grey. Oh, that's the one about Piccadillys. 1, 2, and 3. It's just a hanky panky, more hanky panky, and even more hanky panky.
I guess.
That's what it is. Haven't read it yet? Okay. All right, good. So now, what happened during the 1970s while they were developing these things? At the same time, the physicists were developing fine tuning their models of reality, models of the laws of physics, and they came up with these weak and strong forces, right? So the economists and the market theorists started stealing from them. So we have the weak efficiency hypothesis. This shows us that this tells us that past data on stock prices are of no use in predicting future prices. The problem is stock prices do tend to demonstrate momentum. Stock prices tend to rise more often than we fall, right? So it's every 3 years it goes down, but it doesn't go 1, 2, 3 up and then down one, and it doesn't work that way. But if you go over decades, you'll see it about every 3 or 4 years it's gone up as opposed to going down. And they tend to move far higher than is usually justified, resulting in what's often called a mania or a bubble, or far lower than what is usually warranted, the crash. The market can stay irrational longer than you can stay solvent. This is a very famous quote by Sir John Maynard Keynes. You might have heard of Keynesian economics. And what was going on? There were a group of very sophisticated investors. We today would be called them speculators, hedge fund operators. And they were shorting. They thought that stock prices were way too high. And they were right. Eventually the market did tumble. But people kept bidding up the price. And they complained to Sir John Maynard Keynes that, hey, this is irrational. This doesn't make any sense. These valuations are way out of line. And his famous quote was, the market can stay irrational longer than you can stay solvent. See, when you do bet that the market goes down, the market goes up, you lose a lot of money quickly. And then what the brokerages do is they kick you out of there. They say, oh, you've lost too much money. You've got to go. And so these people could not stay solvent long enough for finally the rationality to kick in. If this theory is true, then technical analysis is useless. And we're going to cover technical analysis on Tuesday. Not very much, because there's really nothing I could teach you that to be of any use to you. You have to believe. You have to believe in witchcraft for it to work, right? Right. Then it works. If you believe in it, it works. If you don't believe in it, it doesn't work. That's how it works. The semi-strong, what a great name, semi-strong efficiency hypothesis. Abnormally large profits cannot be consistently earned using publicly available information. In other words, no amount of analysis that you or I or anybody else does can help them determine the future price of the stock. It will not help them beat the market. But there are many, many investors who have beaten the market over long periods of time. And so if you come up with a theory that says that nobody can do it, and yet people do it, you've got to change your theory, right? So how did they change the theory? They said, oh, those investors are just lucky. And it reminds me of a very famous quote, and it's attributed to many different golfers, but somebody, if you look it up, what? Have you heard it? Okay. It is attributed to many different people, so if you go look it up on the Infernal Net, you'll see but how many people it's attributed to. But he did really, really well and beat all the other golfers out there, or tennis players, or whatever it was. And the reporter said, you know, you were really lucky today. And the guy said, you're absolutely right. And the funny thing is, the more I practice, the luckier I get. And I don't necessarily want to tell you that I'm a fabulous sports fan, which I'm not. I mean, it's very nice. People want to waste 3 hours watching somebody play football and not ever kicking the ball. I haven't figured that one out yet. They kick it every once in a while. Right, anyway. Can you throw a fastball at 98 miles an hour? Not many people can. Can you hit a fastball at 90 miles an hour? 95 miles an hour? Have you ever tried? I was in that batting cage and it went by at 60 and I said, that's it. No, thank you. That was too fast for me. Can you throw a football 60 miles an hour? Not 60 yards. Can you hit one of these little bitty balls 400 yards down the fairway and get in a little cup that big in three shots or a lie, you know? If you can, you're going to make a lot of money. And the same thing is true here. If you can beat the market over significant periods of time, you're going to make a lot of money. But there's not that many people can do it. All right? And it turns out you don't have to be successful, but still. If this theory is true, then all the things we did in chapters 6 and 17, all the analysis we did is basically useless. It's basically telling us that we can't do it. So why bother? Don't even try. Buy an index fund and be happy. Make sense? Or just throw darts at the dartboard and pick your stocks that way. That's what they're saying. And then the strong efficiency hypothesis says that no information, public or private, allows investors to earn abnormally large profits consistently. However, one insider information trade can make you rich overnight. If you don't go to jail, then if you don't get caught. So you see the absurdity in this one? No information, public or private. If you have private information, knowing that this company tomorrow is going to have their drug approved or disapproved, can you see what you can do with that information? That's called trading on material, non-public information. Everybody else calls it insider information. And if you do that, you could go to jail. And some people do. Am I going too fast? Because you're getting really quiet. And when they get quiet, he's like, okay. You know what he's talking about? I don't know what he's talking about. Jail? Carcel? Okay. So, the random walk and efficient market theorists are also major proponents of index funds. They pointed the fact that many professional money managers simply do not beat the market, especially during bull markets, and there's reasons for that. From 1963 to 1998, the S&P 500 index outperformed general equity mutual funds 22 out of 36 times. You would have thought if it were completely random, it would be, 18, one half of this. But remember, a mutual fund has transaction costs. It has annual operating expenses. So you have to at least beat the market by those transaction costs, those annual operating expenses, to break even. Do you understand why it's difficult to beat the market if you're a mutual fund manager? You got to pay for this. The S&P 500 is free. Nobody has to pay any transaction costs. They just make a list of 500 stocks. And that's why these people say you're better off getting a very, very low-cost index fund, and they keep getting lower and lower and lower, instead of trying to beat the market, because they say that nobody can consistently beat the market. However, there are many people who do beat the market. My response is, I want to learn from them. I want to learn what they know how to do, or I want to invest with them. I want to find somebody who's done it over a long period of time. I want to put my money there. Does that make sense? Okay, good. Why can't many pros beat the averages? I got a little ahead of myself. My fault. Many mutual funds have high annual operating expenses and high turnover rates, transaction costs. Many mutual fund managers have very low short time horizon because many mutual fund managers have a very short lifespan. If you work for a company where you know that in the next 18 months, 24 months, if you don't do well, you're out of there. You're making $400,000 to start plus bonuses. What are you going to do? You're going to roll the dice. You're going to make large bets. And if they turn out to be great, whoopee! You get to stay. You get showered with love and attention and money. If you don't do well, oh well, I wasn't going to be there that long anyway. many mutual funds now realize that this is not the way to run a mutual fund. And more of them are doing what T. Rowe Price and American and Dodge & Cox and in some cases Franklin have been doing for decades. And that's allowing their money managers to have a longer time horizon, 4-8 year time horizons. Don't judge them on how well they did over the next 18 months or 6 months. Judge them how well they do over 4 to 8 years. And move them slowly into a position as opposed to just saying, hey, here's $1 billion. Go at it, kid. Do you see the problems? And that's the problem. These people don't understand what's going on behind their mutual funds. Many mutual fund managers have beaten the market. So the premises and the casual observations of the efficient market theories show them to be patently absurd. The more I practice, the luckier I get. But if markets are efficient and rational, how do you explain market manias, also called bubbles? If we're rational people, how can prices of stocks get so outrageously high, or so outrageously low, that's the crash, or, you know, housing, or gold, or whatever, or tulip bulbs. Tulip bulbs. Occasionally, investors get caught up in what are called manias, also called bubbles. The internet bubble of the 1990s was the latest stock mania. Before that, there was the Nifty 50 of the early 1970s. Now, most of you weren't around yet. But do you remember Calcomp or Tektronix? No? How about Metro Media?
No.
How about Polaroid?
Yeah,
you remember Polaroid, but Polaroid's gone. It used to be a company that made these cameras that you took a picture and came out in 60 seconds. It was called the 60-second disappointment. I'm sorry, the 60-second excitement. That's right. And they're gone. And now the name lives on. There are products that are named Polaroid. I don't know why. I wouldn't want to name anything after something that sounded like hemorrhoid. It just doesn't make sense to me to name a company that rhymes with hemorrhoid. But anyway, these were companies that they were called the Nifty 50. If you bought these companies, not to worry. They're only going to go up. In the mania of the 1920s, resulted in the crash in 1929. These were companies that were the cutting edge. Who were the internet and the social media companies in 1928 and 29? Radio Corporation of America. You know it as RCA. It went to $290, and 3 years later, it was $2.90. It's never recovered. Yeah, what?
Slipped my mind.
Right. And the automobile companies at the time. That was Detroit was the Silicon Valley of the time. In the 1840s, there were 400 railroad firms. How many are there now? No, there's more than one. less than five, right, exactly. And the granddaddy of all manias was the Dutch tulip bulb craze of the early 1600s. You don't believe me, but it is true. Tulip bulbs became like securities. They became like stocks. They became like bonds, like mutual funds. They were traded like investments. Now, what happens when you put a tulip bulb into the ground? It grows and it does what all life tries to do, and that's reproduce. So every once in a while, you get a whole bunch of new tulips. And eventually, the stock price just, the tulip price. You know, you don't believe me, but at the time, one of these things would sell for what today would be $1.5 million. So entire fortunes were made and lost. Oh, yeah. Houses for tulip bulbs. There are two wonderful books that you want. You like to read books, don't you? You got another one. Yes, another one. In fact, one of the librarians just retired last year, and she said, "You know, I was thinking of staying a few more years, but I have a list of 300 books I want to read, so I'm retiring now." And I said, "Cool. I have a list of books to read, but not 300." This book was written in the 1840s, and it still shocks you. It's called Extraordinary Popular Delusions and the Madness of Crowds. It talks about witchcraft, the Crusades, the financial peccadilloes of the time. And so check it out. It is a lot of fun to read. And this other book called The Botany of Desire was written in 2000, and he's a very prolific writer. It talks about our relationship with plants and how we believe we control the plants. The plants control us. I mean, wouldn't you like to get somebody to plant you and feed you and keep away all your bugs and all your enemies and weeds? I mean, think about it. These plants have got us trained. We think we're no. Hey, these people are stupid. Hey, it's okay. We're going to make fun. We're going to have fun with them. Every time the phrase was, it's the new era. It's different this time. The old ways of valuing stock are gone. And each time they were wrong. So much for rational, efficient markets. Why do manias occur over and over again? Why haven't investors learned their lesson? Any ideas? Because people are crazy because history repeats itself. We follow the crowd. We're humans. We can't help it. Market manias will happen over and over again because the public is infinitely stupid. Think of how stupid the average American is. And remember, half of them are much stupider than that. And then here is Mr. Graham. Mr. Graham, who wrote The Intelligent Investor, a book that you're eventually going to read. Don't read the first book. Don't have the first book you read. Make One Up on Wall Street the first book you read. The speculative public is incorrigible. It will buy anything at any price if there seems to be some action in progress. It will fall for any company identified with franchising, computers, electronics, science, technology, or what have you, when the particular fashion is raging. The abuses are so largely the result of the public's own heedlessness and greed. Now, he wrote this in 1972. It was his fourth edition. He updated each edition, and he passed away in 75. If you replaced franchising computers with internet, biotechnology, good old Ben could have been writing in 2000, right? Remember? And now, what would you replace them with? Social diseases, networking, and China. And 3D printing, right? Yeah, right. Exactly. How do most manias end? A crash. Yeah, right. The bigger the party, the bigger the hangover. We're coming out of our last hangover. They are not fun, but the odds, dear students, are you will live through at least one or two or three more. They seem to be coming faster and faster. With this many strong years, I have the concern that there are a vast majority of companies that are significantly overvalued on a long-term basis. Now, this guy said this in August of 1999. The Standard & Poor's 500 was, in the last 10 years, was almost 20%. The NASDAQ was doing 80% in that year, 85% in 1999. So this guy looked like a dud. He looked like a dolt. He's a doddering old fool. He's been in the industry for 50 years. And he's saying that stocks are way overvalued. He then retired in 2000. Lucky him. And missed the 2000 to 2002 bear market. And by the way, the 2008-2009 market crash was not caused by a stock market bubble. It was a real estate bubble. And specifically the mortgage-backed bonds that were tied to the real estate mortgages. Makes sense to me? Are you learning something, folks?
Can you kind of see these manias? I mean, it was really obvious about the real estate.
I thought so. No, I don't say no. Some people noticed. Some people, Vanessa, you're absolutely right. Some people noticed. But a lot of people, I was sitting here, this was 2006, I was not here, but I was sitting at this conference, it was with all brokers, right? And they were, at the time, these were all mostly stockbrokers, and they were enticing us to get into the mortgage market, because people were making so much money selling mortgages. So this was a way, we went to this, yeah, exactly. And he thought it was going to continue, didn't he? Right? Totally. And they're trying to sell us on this. Among other, we're talking about other things, but I remember there was a round table or this panel discussion, and I was sitting right up in the front. And they asked the first guy, we'll talk about the real estate bubble, and he said, what bubble? And I just rocked it. You're out of your mind. You really cannot justify these prices. And the guy said, well, what are you talking about? I said, look, these people in this room, we are now looking at selling mortgages. We are brokers for stocks. We're mutual fund investors. Now we're going to sell mortgages? Doesn't that tell you something? This is what people were saying in 1999. I'm going to now move into stocks. I'm going to sell some stocks. And one guy in the front kind of agreed with me, but everybody else just kind of kept quiet, shut up. I don't have to worry. They're not going to fire me. They're not going to fire me. But I don't make that much money from them. They're going to fire me. But you can't. Some people can. Some people can. I told you about my buddy. I don't know if I told you about my buddy. In 2005 and 6, I thought it was a bubble. I knew it was a bubble. I didn't think it was a bubble. I knew it was a bubble. When you see offers that are just too good to be true, when you see prices, and some people, I don't know if you remember, go back and look at the newspaper ads, magazines, and newspaper articles. Some people, especially in LA, were selling their house because the prices had gone up to $1 million, $2 million in Los Angeles, and were renting. Those people now look like geniuses. At the time, people were scoffing at them and telling them that they were nuts. They were absolutely nuts to get out of an equity position in homes. So you can't, you hope that you'll be able to tell them. The greatest trade ever played. Is that the guy who bet against? He bet against the market, yeah.
Yeah, and in Florida that showed him, like, this is what the price of art is.
And he said,
"Do you believe his friend and he made $4 billion?"
Right. But this guy was able to stay solvent. He was betting against the market, and he was able to stay solvent. My buddy, who was not, he started betting against the market in 2005 and 6, and we were both saying this is not going to continue. And I said, Jim, I think prices are going to fall 20-25%. In real estate, which is a big fall in real estate. That's what happened in 1991, 92. He said, no, they're going to go down 50, 60%. I said, Jim, I don't think so. People will do anything to stay in their house. They'll take a second job. They'll take on a boarder, a renter. They'll sell their blood. They'll do anything not to go through foreclosure. He said, no, it's going to be horrible. And he was absolutely right, but he was 2 years too soon. He lost a lot of money betting against the market as it was rising. The stock market or the market itself. Doesn't matter. Stocks, bonds, tulip bulbs, gold. The market can stay irrational longer than you can stay solvent. You can see it coming. Some people don't. But you don't know when. I thought of it in 1999. This is what I was thinking. 1998, 99. I thought of a Greek tragedy. Right, what do you know at the end of a Greek tragedy? Well, everybody's dead, right? There's going to be bodies all over the stage. There's going to be bodies. You just don't know when it's going to happen. And I'll tell you, I was wrong. I didn't think the bubble was going to burst until 2003 or 4. I was pretty sure it started bursting in 2000. And even when it started bursting, we weren't sure.
I just thought it was weird, like, when some of my family, my friends, and stuff, they're buying $1 million houses in Spring Valley.
In 2006 and 7. How did they buy the $1 million house? The optional adjustable rate mortgage, the option arm.
I remember when those new houses got built behind the Spring Valley swap meet.
Mm-hmm.
My friend, she bought one of those houses, and then she foreclosed the house.
Oh, no doubt, because the payment started at $2,800 a month, mm-hmm. And then the next year they went up to $3,500 a month,
and that was when the
Oh, sure. She bought it for $900,000. Now it's selling for $400,000 or $350,000. Oh, yeah. No, she's not alone. So they're going to happen. You're going to live through them. And how you react is going to shape your long-term results. Are you going to run and hide? Are you going to panic? Or are you going to keep putting $50, $100 a month into your mutual fund? Well, you'd like to think you will. You don't know. You don't know. It's one of those things where you really don't know it's going to happen until it happens to you. Here are the 11 worst days of the Dow Jones Industrial Average. Notice that 2008 ranks up there, but it's the 10th. It's not even the worst. But there's October 19th, Black Monday, 1987. But notice that 28th and 29th of October, 1929, basically matched it, but it took 2 days as opposed to just one day. But what I want you to notice is how many days out of 11 are in October? 6, and one's in early November. Why? There are many theories, many ideas that are positive, none of which I think are very good, except for one. And it's the one I believe. But there's no way you can prove it. We are not rational individuals. We are humans. And 100,000 years ago, when a whole bunch of people ran that way, what did you do? You ran with them. Why? Because the people who stood there went, look at those people running those way. Those are the people who got eaten by the tiger. Do you understand? So they didn't get to pass on their genes. It's in our genes. We see a whole bunch of people running that way, we run that way. And this is exactly what happens. We run with the crowd. And what happens at the end of the year? What happens in the fall? Yeah, see, we're divorced from the natural world. We're divorced from the natural world through technology. You walk in, turn on a light, turn up the heat. There's no rain on top of us. But in the fall, we looked around 100,000 years ago, 10,000, even a couple hundred years ago. And we looked around and said, you know what? You know, a lot of us aren't going to be around here in the springtime. And that's why All Hallows Eve, Halloween, Dia de los Muertos, that's why they're in the fall. Because it's the time of death. It's the time when we commemorate those who have gone before us because we know we're going to be there soon enough. And so even though there's no way to prove this, when October comes around, we're still animals, we're still affected by the seasons, and we panic. Death is coming. We all know it's coming for us. We just can wait, wait a little bit longer, you know. I got a way to go. And so, there's no way to prove that, right? You understand? You with me? And so, you're going to live through some of these Octobers. You know, maybe not a lot of them, but you're going to live through a few. And what you have to do is do what? Stay calm. Put more money in. And realize if the whole thing cracks apart, we're all going to die anyway. It doesn't matter. Unless you can get yourself to the southern hemisphere and learn how to raise goats and grow food and eat the part that you think is not poisonous. Good luck. Now, do you recall this slide? Do you remember this slide from chapter 4? You didn't understand it at the time, but now hopefully you'll understand it better. The common mantra among in financial advisors, especially from the financial media, is that instead of trying to beat the market, just buy the market. Just buy the S&P 500 index fund, low cost, or the MSCI World Index Fund, low cost. Make sure you get a low cost one. But sometimes an index can become skewed, can become bent out of shape by whatever mania at the time. Here is the MSCI EAFE. Now, remember, that's international, outside the United States, right? Okay. Now it's being replaced by the MSCI All Country World Index ex-USA. In the 1980s, Japan stock market exploded. It was tulip bulb mania. And by the end of the 1980s, Japan was fully 60% of the EAFE. Now, this includes old Europe, Western Europe, Canada, Australia, Hong Kong, Singapore, the Far East, and Japan. But Japan consisted of 60% of the index with a PE of 52. What is a PE of 52? Things had better stay really good or the parachutes are going to be very large. Everybody else, Canada, Australia, the Western Europe, Singapore, Hong Kong, 40% with a PE of 13. Which is certainly very reasonable. You with me? Japan's stock market then fell 80%. So you bought the MSCI EAFE thinking you were getting a broadly based index of the companies based outside the United States, and what you were getting was 60% Japan with a PE of 52. And the same thing has happened at the end of the 1990s. The S&P 500 had done really, really well. But what had done even better was the information technology, the NASDAQ. It went from 800 to 5,000, 800 in 1999 to 5,000 in 2000, only to fall to 1,200 in the next 2.5 years. You bought fully 33% of the S&P 500 was Dell, Microsoft, Oracle, eBay, AOL, Time Warner. That's when I knew it was going to go. I didn't know it was that soon, but when AOL bought Time Warner, this is it. This is going to happen. With a PE of 59 and everything else, all the other companies in the S&P 500, energy, healthcare, materials, automobiles, food, all those other companies made up this two-thirds of the S&P 500. Still pretty high PE, 19, but not 60. Do you understand? So people will tell you that index funds are the fail-safe, superlative, best, perfect way to invest. And what are you going to tell them? Ain't no such thing. Every investment has advantages. Every investment has disadvantages. In the case of indices, they can get skewed, bent out of shape. You understand the word skewed? A lot of people don't understand that word. Skewed. It means part of it got pushed out. So if you do investing through index funds, you may have to be aware of this potential problem and stay broadly based, you know, maybe the Wilshire 5000. Questions, thoughts? Am I beating a dead horse? No? You learning something?
Absolutely.
Okay, cool. Now, anomalies, silly theories, and oddities. Super Bowl theory. Can you believe that every year at Super Bowl time, this thing gets trotted out in the media and people talk about it? And let's talk about that one first. The theory is that if the National League wins, that's a good sign for the market. Or a football team that was used to be part of the National League. If an American League team, by the way, which one won this year?
National.
Who was it?
National.
Who's that?
Seattle Seahawks.
Are they?
They're in the NFC.
Okay, so that means this market's going to go up. Okay. Oh, well. And the weird thing is that it's been true. It has been uncannily accurate. And people go, well, it must be true if it's always been true. And the problem with that is, have you ever heard of coincidence? Out of the thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of different things that are out there, the likelihood that two of them are going to be similar, just from dumb luck, and if you happen to notice it. Anybody a big Pink Floyd fan? Not too many. Dark Side of the Moon, one of the largest selling albums of all time. I know, good music.
Exactly.
Waters, Gilmore, okay. They made this album, very, very famous album called Dark Side of the Moon. Probably their most famous. I don't think it's their best, but I think it's certainly the most famous.
That's okay. Your opinion.
That's my opinion, right. Okay, I like Wish You Were There. Wish You Were Here. Wish You Were Here. Anyway.
The other one is the one without Roger
Waters. Oh, later. Later stuff. Oh, okay. Well, you're a hardcore, diehard fan. Okay. All right, so it was like Lennon McCartney. Waters and Gilmore, they were, you know, always fighting, but at the same time, they had incredible energy together. But anyway, you listen to this album. At the same time, you turn on your DVD or your VCR, The Wizard of Oz. And it turns out that the scenes change just when the songs change. And then when she winds up the music turn, it's perfect. And they went back and asked the members of Pink Floyd, and because it was done after the Wizard of Oz, and Alan Parsons, who was the producer, who went on to have his own career, did you guys mean to do this? And they looked at me and said, "You're out of your mind. We didn't look at the Wizard of Oz. We didn't. It was total coincidence. Total coincidence. The Monday effect." That's the best day to buy. Or is it the best day to sell? I don't remember. You look it up. The January effect. As goes January, so goes the year. Well, sometimes that's true. Sometimes it's not. The Santa Claus rally. At the end of the year, for some reason, people like to buy stocks. I don't know. But if they don't buy stocks and they sell stocks, they say, oh, it's because of tax selling. You'll read this. And these people make a living doing this, telling you stuff that everybody already knows. Sell in May and go away. Now, there's some truth to this, folks. The best times of the year are November through March. The worst 2 months of the year are September and October. September is actually worse. But if you try to sell and buy and sell based on this information, you're not going to do very well because over decades, the amount is almost imperceptible. You'll be eaten up by commissions and tax consequences. So sometimes September and October are good. Sometimes November through March isn't the best time of the year. So this sell in May and go away. And then how about skirt lines, hemlines? Figured that one out. In 1920s and 1960s, hemlines went up, stock market went up. 1930s, 1970s, hemlines went down, stock market went down. Figured that one out. Right? Yeah, I know. It's amazing, isn't it? And people actually write this stuff and make a living trying to promote this crap. And there's the lipstick indicator, the Boston snow indicator. I like it called the BS indicator. The hot wagers indicator and the amount of aspirin that's being sold. Are you going to place any credence in any of these?
No.
Yeah, Jeremy said, yeah, I will. Because why? If other people believe it, it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. Exactly. And then how about politics and the stock market? What does politics mean? Poly means many, and ticks are blood-sucking insects. Right? Now, which market, which administration, which demagogues or Republicans, which one do you think is better for the stock market? Come on, how many people think Republicans? How many people think demagogues? It's the demagogues. When a Democratic administration is in office, the stock market has done better over the last 100 years.
Clinton.
But what?
Clinton.
Yeah. What does the doorbell sound like when it? Clinton. I got lots of Clinton jokes, but we can't tell them after. No, we can't tell them in class. Not Clinton jokes. No. You can tell Bush jokes. Did you hear Bush was really sad? George W. Bush. No, he didn't die. His father died. No, what happened is the presidential library in Clinton, in Crawford, burned down. Both books were lost. And he hadn't colored the second one yet. He hadn't finished coloring the second one. Those are Bush jokes. Clinton jokes after class. Okay. All right, so anyway. No, you can't do it. You can't get in a lot of trouble here for many things, but that's one of them. It turns out that this is dumb luck. Hoover in the crash of 1929 to 32. Nixon, 72 to 74, and then he out of office. Bush, Reagan, 97, and George W. Bush at the end of beginning of his 2000 to 2002, and then again 2008. So both parties, no matter what their affiliation and their propaganda, both parties are committed to capitalism. Now, one party does believe in more regulation, the Democrats. One party believes in less regulation, the Republicans. However, what we find is that sometimes it's opposite. The Republicans, they believe in less government unless it's in your bedroom, right? And then there are two places, special places in hell. There's one place, special place in hell for people who want too much regulation. And there's another special place in hell for people who want too little regulation. And thankfully, they're right next to one another. So throughout eternity, they get to yell at one another. We got too much regulation. We got too little regulation. Too much. You have too much regulation, stifles competition, stifles innovation. You have too little regulation, you get Bernie Madoff. You get the stock market crash, the housing crash because of the option arms. Okay, so when we come back, we'll finish up chapter 7, do chapter 8, so don't miss Tuesday, and then we have the exam. We will continue with looking at people who have done it, who have beaten the market over long periods of time, and see how they look at certain things, and hopefully do that likewise. And then we'll look at real silliness, and that is the technical analysis. Okay, see you next Tuesday, folks.